The Guardian.
Hello, sports. This is Andy's Ultimate Summer of Sports, Issue 5, the Everything Apart from Football sports podcast that has been rightly overlooked by the Chilcot Inquiry and is not currently overly concerned with a lack of succession planning in UKIP. Sport has its flaws, but it's not going to shit on your cornflakes like actual news, so tuck in for a sweetly nutritious breakfast. Later in the show, we'll be examining whether Andy Murray's internal monologue is actually secretly friends with his external monologue. We'll be interviewing Blitzy the Clown after his failed attempt to become the first man to win the Tour de France on a unicycle. And ahead of this week's European Championships in Sofia, we'll be investigating rumours that, in an effort to help modern pentathlon live up to its name, the old-school disciplines of fencing and shooting will be dropped and replaced for the Olympics, with events more relevant to today's young modern pentathlon fans, such as Instagramming and a general sense of indefinable unease about where the planet is going these days. But first, the sport! Formula One, and it's the British Grand Prix this weekend, and with Mercedes having won 40 of the last 47 races and taking 44 of the last 47 pole positions in qualifying, we ask, does anyone give a shit? And if so, why? And where can Formula One go from here after pulling off the spectacular achievement of making racing cars at 200 miles an hour into the dullest sport on the planet? That is a seriously high tariff manoeuvre. Athletics and Justin Gatlin won the US Olympic trials in a world-leading time of 9.80 before the two-time drug test failure brushed off suggestions that his lane was on a 5-degree downward slope. The fastest baddie in the world thus qualifies for Rio 2016, but will he face Usain Bolt, representing both Jamaica and the forces of good in the universe, who has tweaked a worrying hamstring? And for our Welsh listeners, the Portuguese number 3 ranked tennis player, Frederico Ferreira Silva, well, he lost in the second round of qualifying for Wimbledon a couple of weeks ago. The Portuguese national cricket team really struggling at the moment. Portuguese snooker player João Grilo was not really built on his only appearance in a ranking event when he lost 4-1 to Michael Holt in the Lisbon Open in December 2014. And Portuguese number 1 Joana de Sá Parreira has fallen 5 places to number 1012 in the latest women's golf rankings. So, every cloud.
Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
So let's meet our guests this week. Nick Miller, welcome to your first appearance on the Summer of Sports Sport podcast. How's the summer treating you so far?
Very well, very well. Been watching England bully Sri Lanka in the cricket. That's been,
yes.
That's been entertaining.
Yeah, entertaining in a slightly worrying if Sri Lanka ever going to be any good again kind of way. And Mark Steele returning like a triumphant hero. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you. Yeah, we're talking to the Portuguese snooker there, which I'm not an expert on, but I was watching the billiards one afternoon on Eurosport, and I put on Twitter, like the rest of the country, I'm watching the billiards on Eurosport. And I looked a couple of minutes later, and I'd got a message saying, so am I, Mark, I'm the commentator. Yeah.
So what kind of billiards was that? Was that the billiards?
Oh, proper billiards.
Is that billiards with no pockets or billiards on the full-size table?
No, with the pockets and, right. You know, two for a cannon, two for in off the white, three for pot the red, three for in off the red. Yeah. Come on.
That's because there's different forms. There's
I played billiards in South America once with no pockets. That's very...
Right.
Yeah, that was...
What would they do to try and sort of... You know, they've been trying to sort of sex up snooker in the same way that, you know, that they wanted to do the same with darts. What would they do to try and... Try and jazz up billiards like that.
It's been, I mean, the popularity of billiards has suffered a prolonged decline since the great days of Walter Lindrum. I don't know, I think that horse might have bolted.
Well, the trouble was, they reached perfection. It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, again, it's, you know, where sport can teach the rest of life, because they reached perfection. They could just play the cannons, because for people who may not be as familiar with billiards as all that, you get 2 points for a cannon, which means that your ball hits both the other balls. There's only three altogether. You hit the other person's white and the red. And so they could just do it in such a way that they could just keep that going forever. And you've got breaks. You've got 2 points for that. But you would get breaks of like 8,000. And people could go on holiday. And then they'd get a call. He's missed. Oh, no. The wife's going to go mad. We're just going swimming. And so it could go on for weeks. It really did, didn't it? And so in the end, they just thought, tell you what, we've... we're just going to have to stop. Yeah, and that was the end of billiards,
snooker,
wasn't it?
And snooker took over. And in those days, they played the World Snooker Final up to about 60 frames, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
It'd take a week.
Yeah. So what would you do? I don't know. How could you jazz it up?
Maybe snooker is just the jazzed up version of billiards. They stopped billiards and thought, oh, no, we're going to have something a little bit more high octane. So snooker it was.
What about if you were if there was two people to a billiards team, one that actually played the shot and the other one with a pistol and you could shoot the opponent's ball so that it moved a bit? So you couldn't just...
Yeah, we talked about hybrid sports before. Kind of interesting.
Billiards
kind of
and equestrian.
Yeah.
You're allowed to ride a horse over.
Well,
the
that
table.
Would be good, yeah. Or if you have to be... It was like dressage around a snooker table, but hitting billiard shots once per lap. I would pay to... I mean, because dressage is another sport that doesn't offer a lot to the non-aficionado.
No.
Speedway dressage. Some kind of combination of that.
Tennis!
Wimbledon, whether you like it or not, is heading towards what is often known as the business end of the tournament, although in reality, most of the business deals are actually done well in advance of the tournament starting. The early stage of the tournament, really enlivened by some excellent Serbian action, one of the greatest and stroppiest stropouts in tennis tantrum history by Viktor Troicki, and the third round defenestration of Novak Djokovic, who only a week ago was being heralded as basically unbeatable by august sporting publications such as this one. And, I mean, generally, Djokovic has looked as likely to lose in the early rounds of a Grand Slam recently as Southern Railway has looked to lose in the early rounds of the shittest train company competition, if I may say that. Both Mark and I were delayed on our way in today. So, Mark, as discussed before, you are one of the leading Andy Murray fans in the universe. That was a tough game yesterday.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah, and it sort of it didn't help my sort of Murray illness really at all. But you're not a true Murrayista if at two sets up you didn't think he's going to make a meal of this. If you thought, oh, he's two sets up, the commentators say there's no way back for Songa, this should be easy, then you know, you're just an absolute novice, pathetic. You know he's going to put you through it. But then equally, once it was two sets all, I started to sort of, strangely, I thought, oh, we'll be all right now. You know, especially having Federer. But I've got this. My terrible fear is that, which I thought this last year when Murray got lost, beaten by Federer in the semi-final, is that I just think in 40 years' time, when I'm doddering around a care home and I'm going, can you put the tennis on? Oh, it's Federer. Oh, he's scraped through to the final again. He's 87. It's going to happen, isn't it? Oh,
I hope that happens. I mean, I think they should have cloned Roger Federer just for the sake of tennis, for the sake of beauty and sport. They should have.
Do you think they have done?
Yeah, I hope so.
He can get away with playing just without backhand when he can't run or move or walk, when he hasn't got any knees.
Nobody's just blind. He'll have a dog run on and just knock the ball backwards and forwards, yeah. It's just not. It's extraordinary, isn't it? You would think somewhere in your mind you would go, this is such a lot of effort. I've won 17 of these things. I've got 800,000 titles. I've got cups that I think I don't even remember playing in that tournament, but I appear to have won it. I've got 8 billion squillion pounds. I could easily buy Switzerland. And yet he just has to keep winning.
He obviously, he clearly loves playing tennis. And I guess if you're Roger Federer, the chances are you're not going to find anything else in life you're going to be better at than you have been at being probably the greatest tennis player that's ever lived. But the Federer's comeback was against Marin Cilic. It was an extraordinary, because I've loved watching Federer for 15 years that he's been at the top. How his footwork is going, he's clearly not the force he was. Cilic was blasting him off the court, and you thought, is this it? Is this the end of Federer? And then he pulled out an amazing comeback. Showed him
3 match points.
Yeah. Played a couple of backhands that could have woken the dead. They were so good.
Yeah, yeah.
Glorious.
Yeah. He's playing Raonic in the semi-final, isn't he? He's just a kind of this robot and a completely joyless spectacle of a sportsman against...
He is joyless,
possibly,
isn't he?
And
he looks like a GI from 1958, doesn't he?
I don't think I can think of any other sportsman in whom I have no emotional investment that I want to lose more than him, because he's just so right. Joyless. Because he's...
But he's now got McEnroe in his coaching team. You wonder if he's brought in McEnroe, having said, I've watched videos...
Bring some joy.
Yeah, I've watched videos of myself playing, and I really struggled to get through a whole match of myself. Can you make me more exciting?
Yeah. Take up art or something during the changeover, or something, photography or geology or something. It's really...
watercolours.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. It's... no, you're right. It's so joyous. No one wants him to win. I should think he probably thinks, oh, please beat me.
Yeah.
But I would think that Murray against Raonic, I think Murray would probably win. Against Federer, you don't know, do you?
No, I think Murray's going to win it. I think that might be his
wobble. But this is weird. What an odd thing to be in a position where, Murray will probably win it. There's never, ever...
You didn't think about that about Arvind Palmer or Alex Bogdanovic, did you?
Well, now and again.
Yeah.
But when it was three match points to Murray at Wimbledon 3 years ago, I didn't then think Murray will probably win this.
No,
now.
I put a bet on Djokovic. At that point?
Yeah. What was it? What were the odds?
Something like 200 to 1 or something. I thought, just in case... get some financial compensation for the trauma. But Murray, if he wins, he will become, alongside Fred Perry, the only British man to win Wimbledon twice since the Chilcot inquiry began. So that's something to aim for. I'll say the Songa match, because they talk about it being a roller coaster ride. I'll say it was more like a ride in a Volvo, where it was kind of rock solid with no major alarms for two sets, and then it conked out, and he spent an hour or so by the side of the road,
wait for his seat,
swearing at the car, kicking its hubcaps, and shouting, "Start, you stupid pile of Swedish crap." It just fixed, and he chuddled off on his way, singing along to ABBA songs on the radio. Foul joke on a miss. Andy Zaltzman 1, Sport 4. Not only did we have Viktor Troicki's superb meltdown in the first week, but Pablo Cuevas, subject of Kanye West's Life of Pablo album, he was fined almost £7,000 for two offences: staging a sit-in protest during a match, a protest about tennis rather than a protest about, you know, Brexit or the Syrian situation, and also for threatening to urinate in a ball can on court during a lengthy fifth set. He was not allowed to go for a wee-wee break and threatened to whaz into an empty ball can. And that cost him over £3,000.
But he didn't lose any points for that?
No. I don't know if he'd have lost points if he had actually whazzed in the can.
What is the rule then?
Don't,
I mean, if you just can't control, if it's just got too much and you actually start wetting yourself as you're playing, is that all right?
That's fine.
That's fine.
As long as
you can get a commendation for carrying on in the spirit of the All England game, the Tennis Association, and not besmirching the sport by going in a ball can.
I believe Henri Lacoste did so, the great Frenchman in the 1920s. Was it René Lacoste? I don't know. Anyway, it's one of the great questions of tennis etiquette, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of
They've been abusing it, haven't they?
Yeah,
it's like, you know, I said it was one of the first jokes I ever did when I did stand up when I first started, because you do stuff about school, because that's, you know, not long since you've been there, and it was about teachers. I can't remember this, and they would say, and you put your hand up, "Can I go to the toilet, miss?" And then they'd say, "No," and it was the fifth person in a row, "No," and then they'd say, "Why didn't you go at dinner time?" And I used to think, I've got an answer, but it can't be right because you're on a teacher and I'm six. But when I look back on it, that was the right answer. The reason I didn't go at dinner time is because I didn't want to go at dinner time. And you can't piss in advance, miss, can you? It's not like the bank. You can't say, "Oh, I've got a busy day tomorrow, I won't have time for a piss, I'll have three a day instead." And that's like these poor people at the tennis courts. Yeah. Presumably that's like it. Why didn't you go at one set all?
That's right. So your routine has made absolutely no difference to the world, Mark. Curse of the satirist.
Yeah.
I'd be concerned if I was going to go in a tennis ball can. I'd be quite slightly concerned about the volume, because presumably at that point he was pretty desperate.
Right.
So you'd have to be, would you not have to be quite confident that the tennis can was going to be big enough to...
Well, it's a four-ball can we're talking about here, presumably, isn't it? Or is it a three-ball can? I mean, could make all the difference.
Maybe that's what the umpire was concerned about.
Spinach.
Maybe it was Mr. Cuevas, the referee has informed me that it's a three-ball can, and that considering the anatomy of your good self and the desperation with which we can view that you have reached... We imagine that it won't be sufficient or contain the volume in order to contain the urine that you'll provide. Please continue.
I do feel a bit sorry for Pablo Cuevas, as rather than being remembered as arguably Uruguay's greatest ever tennis player, he's going to be remembered as the guy who threatened to whazz into a ball can. What kind of legacy is that? I think David Cameron's got problems with his legacy.
Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
Well, of course, all sports this week has been overshadowed by the big events. The annual 4th of July Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. Probably the Augusta Masters of Speed Eating. And although whether they should hold it during Ramadan, I've really got issues with. But anyway, won by the great Joey Chestnut, who had his title torn away from him by Matt Stoney after winning 8 years in a row from 2007 to 2014. But he's back on top, Chestnut, with a superb 70 hot dogs in 10 minutes performance. Let's look at the tactics here. We've got Chestnut circled here. And as you can see, guys, he just eats hot dogs as fast as he possibly can. That's tremendous tactics in the circumstances, wouldn't you say, Nick?
Oh, well, Chestnut actually might be slightly disappointed with his performance because I believe last month he set the world record at 73 and a half hot dogs. Oh. That was during the qualifying.
That was qualifying, yeah.
Just to give these people their full names as well, it's Joey Jaws Chestnut and Matt the Megatoad Stoney.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Stoney, he put up a pretty good one. I think he only managed something like 53 dogs in second place, which... But clearly...
There's a huge goal fear then, isn't it?
I mean, when your opponent has laid down 73.5 dog performance in qualifying, psychologically... Even at the highest level of competitive speed eating, that's got to be tough to come back for.
They were hugely ahead of the pack as well. The third place, I believe, was 41 hot dogs.
The women's competition, much closer. Terrific showdown between Sonia Thomas and Mickey Sudo. Sudo coming out on top with 38 dogs to 34. $10,000 top prize for that's... And, of course, Mickey Sudo's on terrific form at the moment, Nick, following up on gobbling 8 pounds of bacon in 8 minutes at the inaugural Delosso Family Farm Bacon Fest World Bacon Eating Championships.
You couldn't do two in a day, could you?
In Lathrop, California. I mean, that's...
Well, I don't know, maybe you could. There are different techniques to this. There's, you know, people have different... Some people prefer to sort of, you know, starve themselves a little bit before, but some people... The day before, they prefer to eat an awful lot, so they stretch their stomach out a bit.
Oh, blimey.
So it causes great schisms in the world of...
Do they have nutritionists?
One would assume not.
I took part in a contest like this when I was doing the in-town show in Wigan. And I happened to be in Wigan at the time of the National Wigan Pie Eating Contest. But... The good people of health and safety had changed the rules. It wasn't like that. Joey would have been most perturbed. It was just who could eat one pie quickest because it was deemed that it'd been over the years. It's been like, well, this is just dangerous to eat so many pies and so on or whatever. And so it was just who could eat a pie the quickest. And I was sort of drafted into it. I came, you know, very poor last, of course. I was about 20 huge blokes. And they all got this pie. And the bloke who was next to me clearly won. And the winner was deemed to be the bloke who was sort of was someone else. And
then the judge, had he cheated?
The judge said to me, "No, he had some gravy down his chin. He hadn't finished." I said, "What? What are you talking about?" And then he went, "He's not from Wigan, that one." Oh. And the bloke was from Manchester or something, and it was just blatantly fixed. I was fuming. The sports fan in me was absolutely furious.
Isn't it Roy Jones Jr. in Olympic boxing in 1984? All over again. So I hope I've got the right boxer there.
How did this work? Did the individual eat a pie at a time, and then it was he had the time?
No. It was all in. Everyone was in a circle.
Right. Okay.
And everyone got a pie, and then boom, and then. I think the previous year there had been controversy as well because the guy who owns the pub where it had taken place had all the pies ready the night before, but his dog ate them. and this caused some chaos, yeah.
Right. It was, in fact, 1988, the Roy Jones Jr. reference. Got the wrong year. Foolishly, of course, it would have been home Olympics for him in 84. He'd never have lost. But Joey Chestnut, I mean, he is... one of the all-time greats of competitive speed eating. He's got some sensational world records. Holds the world record for deep-fried asparagus eating.
All right.
12.8 pounds of deep-fried asparagus in 10 minutes.
12.8 pounds?
Yeah.
A field's worth of asparagus.
It is a lot of asparagus. And this is an interesting double to hold. Holds the world record for most pork ribs eaten in 12 minutes and most matzo balls in 8 minutes. Okay. So, which, you know, as a as speaking as a lapsed Jew, that's Jewish not always thing, a biathlon that you're entitled to go for. But he's pretty much, I mean, he's the Roger Federer of speed eating almost.
Skinny people have an advantage in speed eating because they're it's easier for them to breathe. There's less sort of fat pressing upon
right.
them.
Young, because they're all quite, all the top people are quite young and athletic.
You have
looking.
To, oh, yeah, it's an endurance sport. You have to be quite fit.
Yeah.
Really? All right, good.
A fitness you, of course, ruined by eating 70 hot dogs.
And it does, I mean, this event gets like a TV audience in America of about 2 million every year. That's, I don't know if it's a sport or just like a satire on the excesses of capitalism. I don't know. It's a fine line, isn't it? Football's going the same way, to be honest.
It's well regulated by, of course, Major League Eating. That's the governing body, of course.
Yeah. I mean, according to legend, the contest began on July the 4th, 1916, when four immigrants held a hot dog eating contest at Nathan's famous hot dog stand on Coney Island to settle an argument about who was the most patriotic. I don't know how patriotism is expressed through the medium of hot dog eating. Do you have to eat more or fewer or just
this is
faster?
You know what this is, if Trump gets in, he'll probably allow one Mexican a year to stay, but you've got to eat 50
hot dogs.
In
no them. Tacos. No yeah. tacos.
No, 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 no.
You come here,
they'll be the other side of the wall.
Have you seen the technique these people use as well? The technique favorite, I believe, the in fashion technique these days is. Yeah. To
you've take, done some research on this. I admire absolutely. This, Nick.
Yeah. To take the hot dog, remove the sausage, break the sausage in half, shove that into your mouth, and then dip the bun in your favoured fluid. So some people use water, some people use some kind of broth, and then you shove that in your mouth,
right.
and there you go.
Yeah. So I don't think that should be legal. I think you should have to eat the dog in the bun.
Yeah.
I'm a traditionalist when it comes to this. That, to me, feels like cheating.
Mm.
But I know water is widely used now on the...
Is it?
Competitive. I have a memory of speed eating. For one of my earliest memories, I had to eat a Jacob's cream cracker against my brother when we were about age
just
six
one.
And four. And to eat half because I was smaller than him.
Oh, it's handicapped
front,
then,
in front of a
speed
crack.
Eating.
Yeah.
Was it dry?
And it was incredibly dry.
Right.
I mean, the memory has stuck with me. Not just the memory of the biscuit, but the memory of the pain of defeat as well.
Cricket!
Moving on to cricket, and this week England take on Pakistan in a four test series beginning at Lord's on Thursday. The early part of the international summer has been a ceremonial thrashing of Sri Lanka in three formats of the game. It's not been great to watch from a neutral cricketing point of view, although England have played well. But the exciting aspect of the Pakistan series is the return of Mohammad Amir, who was last seen on these shores being a very, very naughty boy in 2010 in the spot-fixing scandal. But he's back now. He served his five-year ban. He's still young. He's about 24 years old, I think. And he's starting to look very, very good. He took three wickets against Somerset in a warm-up match the other day. And he wasn't just making the ball talk. He was making the ball break down in tears and confess a string of unsolved murders dating back to the 1950s. It was seriously impressive bowling. He bowled out Peter Trego of Somerset with a ball so good he could have informed him 2 months in advance in writing exactly what he was going to bowl.
Yeah, there could have been three batsmen, couldn't there, at once, and it would have gone for all of them.
Would have, And he bowled out... he got Triscothic with an outswinger so perfect it would have been almost a disgrace not to edge it, just from an aesthetic point of view. And I think he served his time, Mark. What's your view on this?
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a beautiful innocence about him because he was 18, was he, when he was done? And 2 or 3 weeks after he was done and banned from cricket for 5 years, he then turned up again playing cricket, defying the ban. Do you know where he turned up?
It was somewhere in England. I forget where exactly.
He played in the club that I play for is in a league down in Surrey. That's quite a long way down the sort of league structure, and he turned up in that league playing either for or against Addington Village, and of course, like loads of people went, and he was so innocent. He didn't go, look, don't tell anyone. I'm supposed to be banned. You might have seen me in the News of the World. He didn't do that. He just went, and they all took pictures of him, and they were all putting it on whatever, the social media things were at the time. And, of course, eventually it got back, and the league people thought, that's Mohammad Amir. And, of course, he took, 8 for 3 or whatever it was. And so he was, I think his ban was extended or something, or he was fined another 30 quid or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
So I think there's an innocence about it.
Yes. It was all rather tragic, really. But it could be a big test for England, this, Nick. And last time Pakistan were here, we really struggled against their bowling and had their batting not been slightly sub-primary school third team level, then England might well have lost that series.
Well, and you know, England haven't exactly been toughened up by the summer of cricket so far. So, yeah, there could be big problems. Well, I think the thing I like about Amir the most is not only is he ludicrously talented, but he's, those wickets he was taking against Somerset, he celebrated them like, you know, like they were World Cup winning. He's sort of the Pippo Inzaghi of cricket. Yeah. Not quite Imran Tahir levels of celebration, but he enjoys taking a wicket.
Yes, well, if it was Pippo Inzaghi, I mean, he wouldn't have actually bowled the ball himself, would he? He'd have like, he'd have gone past the batsman. He'd have like caught it and hit the stumps himself with it, and then celebrated as if he'd done it. That's a niche joke. Anyway, now England have just announced their squad for the first test. They've recalled Gary Balance of Yorkshire.
You pleased with that?
Well, not massively. No, I mean. I like the stylish side of the game of cricket, and Balance as a batsman is well, he's in the Graham Smith category, I would say. No doubt he's a good player, but you know, I like him.
You'd say he is to batting what 1950s billiards is to sport.
But they've also called up Toby Roland Jones, the Middlesex fast bowler with a heroically long run up, proper old school 1970s fast bowler's run up. And Nick, you told me something just before we came on air. Is it, does this count as on air in a podcast?
Yes, Toby Roland Jones, if he plays, he'll be the first double-barreled England cricketer to play since a man called Norman Mandy Mitchell Innes, who played in 1935. He played one test, he scored 5 runs, he didn't bowl, and then he had to miss the next test due to a severe bout of hay fever.
Right, oh, the selectors weren't forgiving of that, kind of thing in those days, were they?
He'll be the 5th double-barreled player to play for England, or 4. This is, I think there's some controversy about this. Right. The other ones are George Simpson Hayward, Hugh Bromley Davenport, excellent name, and Sir Henry Levinson Gower. Now, Levinson Gower is the controversial one because he sometimes gave his name with a hyphen and sometimes didn't. So I believe there's some debate as to whether that truly qualifies as a double-barrelled surname.
Right.
Oh, good. Okay. Kent have got a player, Bell Drummond, who's done very well this year.
Yes. So, well, he's been hotly tipped for a potential future.
Yeah, so he's probably really, really disappointed that he didn't sneak in there.
Well, who knows? I mean, Roland Jones might not play and Bell Drummond could kind of sneak in.
When
what about Rachel Hayhoe Flint? She must have played for the England women.
Yes, a lot. So England women have some terrifically named cricketers. Betty Snowball was a particular. She was, I think, in the early days of women's test cricket. That is a name with change to get the bus home.
That's brilliant. Enid especially Bakewell for cricket, well. Isn't it? That's fantastically.
Enid Bakewell, one of England's finest women cricketers. That's a strong name, I think, as well. Not enough Enids in the world these days. I mean, it's not the biggest problem the world faces.
It's up there, though.
Yeah.
Repeat after me. I do solemnly swear, by almighty sport to watch the sport, the whole sport, and nothing but the sport. So help me, sport.
Well, the Tour de France is up and running now. Or not running, I guess. Mark Cavendish has added a couple of stages to his spectacular collection of stage wins. I find tour cycling utterly baffling as a non-expert. That's, you know, you have Cavendish winning all these stages but with no chance of winning the race. You have, it's one of the few sports you can watch and have no idea who's good and who isn't by watching.
No, not watching them. Do you follow it?
Well, since I'm going to be live blogging it on Saturday, yes, I definitely do.
Well, it's fascinatingly epic, isn't it? I mean, 3 weeks cycling up and down mountains.
Can't tell who's winning.
Yeah, and the tactics seem a bit baffling. And also, the big thing I have a problem with is choosing a team as a neutral. Because when you're choosing between the likes of Astana, which is a collection of state-owned companies from Kazakhstan, I mean, there's not a lot in that for the neutral.
So, how are they doing?
Team, all right, I think. Team Sky, which, I mean, they've done a great deal for British cycling, but at the same time, you know, we have a slightly nuanced relationship with Mr. Murdoch in this country, I think. FDJ, which I think that's sponsored by the French National Lottery, or an American comedian, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is a novelty act impersonating the wartime president. Giant Alpecin, that is part German shampoo company and part, I don't know, giant. And Lotto NL Jumbo, which, I mean, there's not a lot to really think, oh, yeah, I'm Lotto NL Jumbo till I die. How'd you get into it as a neutral?
So when you're talking about the when you talk about the cricketers earlier on, and you prefer the stylist over the, you know, more pragmatic thing, is there such a thing as a stylist in cycling?
Well, they do talk about this on the the commentary. So he's got a lovely style, or something. I'd say he's a bit hunched over his.
There's some. This must sound so ignorant to anybody who knows.
There's a lot of ignorance flying around this table right now, and I'm happy with that. I'm happy to be ignorant about road race cycling.
Maybe it should be through the London. See, that'd be one, wouldn't it? Where you had to have all sort of lorry drivers and that. Oi, shut, get out. I had one, because I'd cycled quite a bit, and I was cycling in London. This bloke went, I'll see if I get the exact words right. Huge, you know, you sort of get used to just sort of, if you're cycling at the lights in London or any big city, you just sort of wave just to make sure they've seen you, a big lorry, because otherwise they're looking around at the lights.
Yeah, they just see you as a human triple 20.
Well, they don't even notice. They're fiddling about in it. Yeah, exactly. They're in the glove compartment here getting a Twix and on their phone and that, and then the lights going off. They go, yeah, all right, Dave, boom. Yeah, I'll see you down. No, it's nothing, mate. Cyclist. No, put a stop, mate. He's dead. I'll see you down in Webber Springs at 8. So you're sort of used to that. And then, you just sort of get used to just making sure. And usually they go, all right, mate, I'll see you. And then this one bloke, he went around his window, huge, great truck, and he went, "Oi, pay road tax. You pay fuck off." Marvellous set of words, isn't it? He must have thought, not only, right, I'll tell you what.
That's a haiku, isn't
it? Yeah, he must.
I like
that. He must have thought, here is someone I want to get off my chest, my anger about the situation in which I am compelled to pay towards the upkeep of the nation's highways, whereas he is exempt from this particular tax on account of having two wheels as opposed to my 268. On the other hand, I want to tell him to fuck the hole. Now I've got to bloody mix the two together. It's come out all incoherent, hasn't it? I've ruined everything, hasn't it? So if they had to go through the middle of that, the peloton.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be able to identify with it a little bit more. Then wouldn't we think, oh, the Kazakhstanis won't be used to this. They don't get this on the steps.
It's quite a spectacular sight seeing the peloton. It came through Tunbridge Wells once.
Did it? Well, they lost.
Came through Tunbridge Wells. It appeared to be lost. They stopped to buy some second-hand books and some antiques and went on their way. They all had to vote Conservative before they left. And then off they went.
And Team Sky have made things difficult for themselves there. They've got an ancient globe that they've got to carry now. a set of Dickens.
Lash it to their panniers and they're on their way.
Yeah, it's quite a spec. I mean, you kind of sit there waiting for, I mean, it must have been the early 90s, I think. And the Tour de France came through Tunbridge Wells. And it was a wait around for half an hour. And then a load of motorbikes and cars come through. And then whoosh. 150 cyclists, and that's it. They've gone. Like 5 seconds of whoosh, and you've seen one of the greatest sporting events in the world. Bizarre. Odd sport. But could be another win for Chris Froome, by all accounts, if he can overcome the challenge of Vincenzo Nibali, which is another terrific name. So, that's about it for this week. Next week, we'll try and have some genuine expertise on the Tour de France from someone who knows at least slightly what they're talking about, or hopefully even a lot what they're talking about. We'll be reporting on UFC 200, following the big news that John Jones, the number one ranked pound-for-pound fighter in UFC, has been ruled out of his scheduled I'm going to smash you in the face showdown against Daniel Cormier in Las Vegas due to a doping violation. There's no light heavyweight unification match. How are you coping with the disappointment?
Don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, it's tough.
I'm more confused about that than I'm about the Tour de France, to be honest.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's all, rather than watch the UFC, just watch some billiards instead.
Yeah.
Well, oh, it's billiards. Brilliant, the billiards.
Yeah, let's watch. Everybody, go. That's your homework for this week, listeners. Go away and watch some billiards. There are some videos on YouTube. Some billiards videos. I know that for a fact. Right, it's time to finish this. Thank you very much for joining me for the Summer of Sports podcast. We'll be back next week with some golf. It's open golf next week and some other stuff. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.